Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopez. And today I'm joined by Dr. Terence Deacon. He is currently professor of anthropology and member of the cognitive science faculty at the University of California, Berkeley. His theoretical interests include the study of evolution-like processes at multiple levels, including their role in embryonic development, neural signal processing, language change, social processes, and focusing especially on how these different processes interact and depend on each other. Professor Deacon's research has combined human evolutionary biology and neuroscience with the aim of investigating the evolution of human cognition. He is the author of The Symbolic Species, The Coevolution of Language and the Brain, and his most recent book, Incomplete Nature, How Mind Emerged from Matter. This book explores the relationship between thermodynamic, self-organizing, evolutionary, and semiotic processes, and provides a new technical conception of information that explains both its representational and normative properties. So, Dr. Deacon, welcome to the show. Thank you a lot for accepting the invitation.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So I would like first to ask you, how did it happen that you got into a position where you have sort of an interdisciplinary approach to these many different subjects that I talked about in the introduction? Because if I'm not mistaken, you studied several subjects spanning from physics to anthropology. So how do you present yourself academically, and how did you get to that point of an interdisciplinary approach?
Well, largely it's because of my background and because I've changed my interests over time. I actually began my studies as an undergraduate student in physics, but became much more interested in biology after that, in that process. But it was really in the late 1970s I came across the writings of a philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce, end of the 19th century, beginning of 20th century philosopher, that really caught my attention. And as a result, I went as a graduate student to Harvard to study his works, because his unpublished works were hiding in a library at Harvard at the time. But I was actually not able to get to them because they were so carefully protected. And I ended up shifting to the neurosciences and eventually to anthropology as a graduate student. Studying the anatomy of primates that was related to the anatomy of human brains, particularly with respect to language. But of course, that background, the background coming from physics, coming from basic biology, evolutionary biology, and so on, and then leading me through this, I was constantly interested in how brains develop and evolve. The result is in the 1990s, I began work with another colleague, Ulla Isaacson, studying neural regeneration and transplantation. And we did some studies taking fetal neurons and transplanting them into other species' brains. Eventually, one of his interests, of course, was to develop a therapeutic procedure. So I sort of pursued that for a while. And then when I moved to the University of California in the early part of this century, I decided that I would go back to my original interests. And so what you see in my career, in effect, is changing from topic to topic, but continuing the thread, allowing the thread of what I've learned before to sort of follow after me. And so that's my interests reflect a circuitous background as well. I was lucky enough to not ever fall out of favor because of my flitting from topic to topic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very interesting. And so now you are a professor of anthropology. Would you say that anthropology is a discipline that gives you some space to have an interdisciplinary approach that perhaps other disciplines would not?
To some extent. I think that when I began in the field, I was talked into anthropology in part from a sometime mentor years and years ago named Gregory Bateson, who was an anthropologist. And basically he said, whatever you want to do, you can probably do in anthropology, given what your interests are. I think that to some extent, anthropology has wandered away from that. It's become more entrenched in both the biological side of things and the cultural side of things, so that people on both sides of that sort of two cultures divide don't tend to talk to each other enough. I wish it was more so. The cognitive sciences, on the other hand, have become much more accepting of that kind of interdisciplinary work. And so my role as a cognitive scientist as well has allowed sort of all of those sides of my thinking to become relevant.
Mm-hmm. Very well. Okay, so now let's get into some of the main topics of your latest book, Incomplete Nature, and try to build up from physics to the human brain and also societies and mental processes and things like that. So would you say that perhaps one of the main things that come from physics that people have to understand to really understand how biological systems operate is the second law of thermodynamics and how biological systems deal with it?
It clearly is a central part of the problem. I mean, the real issue is that second law of thermodynamics is so ubiquitous in the world. And of course, at the macroscopic level with molecules and creatures of our size, it is the major force. What I think is both the relevance of it and the intellectual danger is that we sometimes think it's the only problem to deal with. So a lot of very, very prominent work in the area of the origins of life and this relationship between physics and chemistry on the one hand and life on the other hand has been about the generation of order and the prevention of breakdown and dissolution from the second law. But in fact, I don't think that's the critical story. And the reason I say it's a distraction to some extent is because we then have become very focused on what processes that are sometimes called self-organizing, processes that generate order at the cost of pumping disorder into the world, so to speak. This kind of idea actually dates back to Erwin Schrödinger. But the fact is that that's not the whole story. It's not just that we're orderly, that we not only are orderly, but we maintain order over a long period of time. And our bodies, all the way down to bacteria, are in the process of not only doing that, but seeking environments that help us maintain that order and helping us preserve the order that's there despite the fact that conditions have changed. And I think that the one feature that maybe distinguishes physics and chemistry from life and mind is not just order, but it's what I call normativity, or what the philosophers call normativity. That is, in physics and chemistry, there are not good or bad things. They're not things that work or don't work. They just happen. But for living things, there's good or bad conditions. There's things that function and fail to function. This transition to the normative world, a world where you can have sort of things that work, don't work, or right or not right, or accurate or inaccurate. These are not things that happen in physics and chemistry. These are things that life brings into the world. And so part of my work was to say, no, it's not just the second law. The second law is absolutely important because it's where everything has to start at this level. But it's not defeating it, so to speak, using the second law against itself the way life does, is not the whole story. And I think we've stopped prematurely by looking at just that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in your book, you talk a lot about the notion of absence, and as I understand it, how constraints work toward organizing the physical processes that then give rise to higher order phenomena, let's say, like some properties of the mind. So could you tell us about the notion of absence and also how constraints work?
Right. So the notion of absence is linked to the notion of constraint, obviously. And absence is sort of a generic and somewhat philosophical and abstract way of talking about things that are constrained, things that don't happen, things that are prevented. In one sense, I use the concept of absence almost as a springboard to talk about it more technically a little later in my work. But the key issue here is that everything I just said about normative features, features that have sort of two sides to them, a polarity to them, is that it's always about something that is not exactly there. And I begin the book, for example, talking about absence from the concept of zero, for example. The issue is that all of life, because of the second law of thermodynamics, is continually dealing with the potential for things to become absent, order to break down, raw resources to not be present, and so on. And so organisms are always working against this tendency to lose stuff, to become absent in some way or another. Literally, the biggest absence, of course, is not existing. So we're always sort of, to use Darwin's phrase, the struggle for existence is what life is about. But it's not just existence and struggling with other organisms. It's just to stay ahead of the second law of thermodynamics. So absence is always a part of us. But I think we also recognize that in terms of just thinking and thought processes themselves, it's about things. When we say something is about something, what it's about is not it. So if you think about just a word, the meaning of a word, it's nothing that's intrinsic to the word. It's something that's literally absent and yet brought into focus by the presence of that word. But the same thing is true of a thought. And of course, this idea has been around for a long time, particularly since the 19th century, when the concept of intentionality, which is basically being about something, becomes a sort of major influence in the philosophical thinking. How is it that, everything that bodies do and brains do is about something? Organisms' adaptations are always about the world and about things that might happen but haven't happened. And of course, in the process of reproducing, everything that an organism is doing is about something that hasn't happened yet. So the future, the absent future, the not quite existent future is critical. The problem that I was trying to deal with is, how does physics get organized around things that aren't there? How do physical processes become organized around things that are not yet happening or could happen or are in need of prevention? That's what life is all about, all the way down. But it means that that's also what life is about at the level of mental activity as well. The thoughts I have are not in my brain. The aboutness of my thoughts is not stuff going on in my brain. My brain is giving me access to it, but it's not there. So there's a troublesome not there issue that sort of has to be taken into account. And I think the real problem is that we that come from a materialist sort of physical perspective only want to deal with stuff that we can put our hands on, that have intrinsic properties, that are there. But what I wanted to focus people's mind on is that, in fact, when we deal with life, we have to pay attention to what's not there as well.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say that physical constraints are what allow for life chemistry to go through these self-organizing processes that then lead to order, for example?
Yes. So clearly one of the things that does happen to make things self-organize is that constraints, limitations, and biases can multiply under certain circumstances. And simplest kinds of examples are things like whirlpools in a stream. A whirlpool forms because there's a bias. Say a stone is dropped into the stream that's large enough to distort the flow, the laminar flow. And as the system tries to reorganize itself, it's simply the water moving downhill, so to speak, what happens is it forms a sort of regular circle for the same reason that those things that are not flowing circularly tend to get in each other's way. That, in a sense, the flow is simpler if it flows circularly. And so all over time, you drop the rock in the water, and initially it creates a turbulence, and the turbulence resolves itself into a regularity. And what's happened is the constraints have all aligned and become organized and allow the flow to, in effect, be more efficient downstream. So to some extent, self-organization happens as a result of these kinds of constraints multiplying and compounding on top of each other. The problem is that's not enough to explain life. Life has to have that happen, but that's not enough. Because what you need is something like a whirlpool that, when you take the rock out of the water, keeps itself going somehow. Self-organization requires all of it's sometimes called self-organizing, even though there's no self to do it. What we mean by that, the prefix self under those circumstances, is that, in a sense, it's not forced into this regularity. The regularity sort of spontaneously develops. But when we talk about organisms, everything is about self. They're defending themselves, they're reproducing themselves, they're feeding themselves. This notion of self now is not just metaphoric, like it is in the phrase self-organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very well. So also in your book, you spend a lot of time dealing with some other concepts like homeodynamics, morphodynamics, and teleodynamics, and I think these concepts are very crucial to the thesis you put forward in your book. So could you explain to us each of them and how they basically work?
All right. What I wanted to do, and what this is about, is to talk about the steps from thermodynamic processes to living processes. And my original comments today were to suggest that just getting order is not enough. There needs to be another step that we've tended to ignore. And so I came up with these three terms to sort of capture the transitional steps. And the term homeodynamics are about dynamical processes of change that tend to towards homogenization, hence the term. Most thermodynamic processes, particularly in closed systems, but also in a lot of open systems, tend towards homogenization. They tend towards evening things out. I wanted to use a term different than thermodynamics, in part because there are other processes that we wouldn't necessarily automatically jump to with thermodynamic processes. So, for example, even at the atomic scale, we talk about, for example, lasers, in which you pump up electrons to a higher energy state that's unstable. And what happens is that over time, they give off energy, the electrons fall down to a lower energy state in producing the laser light. But that lower energy state is not going to be easily described as thermodynamic. And yet it's, in a sense, it's going down to, you might say, a lower energy state. It's homogenizing. It's harder to go to a lower energy state than that. It goes to its bottom state. Well, to some extent, thermodynamics is about going to this evened out state so that things can't go any more even. When we say something is in equilibrium, that's what we pretty much mean. Or what we say also, it's at maximum entropy. Maximum entropy is also a state that it takes work to push something out of it. Just like it takes work to push an electron out of its lowest orbital. So I use the term homeodynamics as a sort of broader generalization in which thermodynamics is a major part of it. And with respect to life, thermodynamics would be enough because we basically don't have to deal with some of these quantum effects and so on. The term morphodynamics, I wanted to use to talk about what are typically talked about as self-organizing processes, as I just described them. And the term is meant to say that these are dynamics that tend to fall into forms, morpho, form. And so a whirlpool is a morphodynamic process. But also, so is the growth of a snow crystal, a morphodynamic process, or the growth of what we call convection cells in a heated liquid, a heated oil, for example. You get these regular convection cells in which fluids are moving in very precise and sometimes precisely hexagonal columns of fluid and so on, simply because of the close packing of this sort of dynamics. These are morphodynamic processes, but crystal formation, like in snow crystals, but in any kind of crystal, is a morphodynamic process. It's a process in which going towards a more relaxed state, something becomes more orderly. Now, it turns out that a whirlpool is a good example of a state that is orderly despite the fact that it's constantly changing. Some of the most interesting morphodynamic processes, and those that are relevant for life, are states of constant change that are orderly. Normally, when we think about perturbing systems when they're in constant change, we think about them getting more chaotic. Turns out that chaotic processes are using some of the same dynamics, but they're in the case that, in a sense, they continually undermine any kind of regularity. It's those subsets that become regular that we're interested in life, because life requires regularity. The problem, as I mentioned before, is that regularity by itself isn't enough for life. Regularity can form in simple physical and chemical systems, like crystal growth, or like catalytic processes, and I talk about what we call autocatalytic or circularly catalytic processes, where one catalyst aids the production of another catalyst, which aids in some way the catalyst, the first catalyst's activity, so that you get things that become more organized, farther from equilibrium. That is, they sort of go in the opposite direction than homeodynamic processes. The problem is that since they are totally dependent on the external world, or that is, like the whirlpool is, or have to get frozen so there's no more change, like in a crystal, that's not going to be sufficient for life. What living things need to do is that they need to maintain these morphodynamic processes, but stabilize them. And what I realized is that that's going to require an additional step, an additional kind of dynamics. And I realized that the only way that can happen was that if two or more morphodynamic processes each produce the boundary conditions that the other needs. And if you get that kind of circularity of morphodynamic processes, you now have a system that maintains and stabilizes itself. Because as each system moves towards equilibrium to break itself down, to dissipate, the other system will create the environment that maintains it, and vice versa. And so you get this reciprocity of morphodynamic processes, and I call that teleodynamic. Teleodynamic because it now has a sort of intrinsic end, a telos. The intrinsic end is self-maintenance. It tends to maintain itself despite disturbance. And that, of course, is the key to life. But because of that, because a living system or a teleodynamic system by itself is supported morphodynamically, supported by non-equilibrium, far from equilibrium processes that maintain order, it must constantly be also interacting with its environment. It must be taking advantage of its environment to maintain itself somehow. And that turns out to fall out spontaneously so long as you have these reciprocal morphodynamic processes. And that reciprocity, I think, is what makes life possible. It can happen by accident. It can initiate by accident. Not easy. Morphodynamic processes are rare in the world. most things go to equilibrium and regularities break down. And teleodynamic relationships should be even rarer to spontaneously show up. And yet the difference is that because a teleodynamic system, like a living system, is self-maintaining, it organizes itself to preserve the regularities, it will tend, once it exists, to spread and reproduce itself, to generate more of the same. And that's what we see, of course, with life. Even though life is utilizing processes that are probably in the global universe extremely rare and rarefied, as soon as they start where conditions are right, they'll spread and they go all over the place, precisely because they have this additional feature, what I call teleodynamics, that is, they're directed towards their own ends. They have, in this case, there can be things in the environment that are good for them and bad for them. Their internal dynamics can be functional or malfunctional. So now, once you have this reciprocity of morphodynamic processes, of self-organizing-like processes, once you have it, you also have normativity, that missing piece that I suggested we've missed out on, we haven't paid attention to.
Okay, very well. So just before we get from those, let's say, strictly physical processes up to higher order mental phenomena, let's say, I just wanted to ask you this, because at a certain point there, you refer to the fact that perhaps it's a bit unfortunate that because we nowadays have this naturalistic approach that sometimes we only are worried with the things that we can get our hands on directly. But I think it is important for people to understand that, and I think that most people don't know about this, that nowadays in physics, and from for several decades now, I think, information is also treated as something that exists, right?
Right. I think, unfortunately, the term information has lost its classic meaning, its traditional meaning in the sciences and in technology. In fact, there's a chapter of the book I'm working on now that's called How Information Lost Its Meaning, which happened just at the beginning, the middle of the last century, particularly under the influence of a man named Claude Shannon, who developed what was then called the mathematical theory of communication. He actually warned against overusing the term information in a technical sense to talk about information in all possible senses. But what we normally think about information, it's about informing, creating form, generating form, in a sense, creating in my mind, in your mind, by conversation, a new form, transmitting aboutness. So the term to be about something in English is, of course, totally appropriate to the concept of information. When somebody provides me with information, it's usually about something. And for me, I can add something in addition to that. Is it significant? Is it meaningful to me? Is it useful for me or not? And it's only its aboutness that's useful. On the other hand, we're all using computing these days, and in fact, this conversation is taking place on that. We measure the information that can be held in the hard disk, for example, or the amount of information that can be passing between us, for example, on the internet in this conversation. And we can measure it irrespective of what it's about. We can say, I don't care what it's about. I want to know how many bits per second can be transmitted on this line. And I call that measure a measure of information. But now what I've done is I've backed away from the full concept of information to talk only about, you might say, its medium or signal characteristics. Shannon, as a person working for Bell Telephone Labs at the time, of course, this was a critical issue. And interestingly enough, his background was that before that he was working on encryption during the Second World War. So that dealing with encryption, you don't necessarily know what it's about, but you want to figure out how to organize it in such a way that you can get to its aboutness to some extent. But you can do all kinds of analyses without knowing what it's about. And that allowed technicians at the time to begin to think in these terms, to think of information in terms of just what you might call properties of the medium itself. And so we began to figure out ways after his work in the 1950s to actually measure, get a precise measure of things like bandwidth, storage capacity on our various devices, and so on, by mathematical analysis that was quite precise and has made the engineering of all the devices we use today possible, because we can now use it as an engineering feature. The problem is that concept of information gets rid of what information is about. It doesn't get rid of it as much as just ignores it. It says that for the purposes of engineering, it's not necessary. Now, what something is about, as we began in this conversation to struggle with, is not something present. It's not an intrinsic property. So there's what my words are about are not intrinsic to the physics of the sounds that I'm producing, the electrons that are carrying this across to you, for example. It's not an intrinsic feature, not something you can hold on to. So it was very convenient, it seems to me, for this concept of information to become much more influential in the sciences in the last half century of the 20th century. And what happened is, of course, it became a topic for genetics, it became a topic for cognition, for neuroscience, and of course for computing. It even became a way that people talked about evolution and how evolution works as an information process. Because that way of talking about information doesn't seem to force you to talk about this absent stuff. Now, what's interesting is that hidden in Shannon's original analysis was that he was interested in both what you might call how much information can be transmitted on a particular channel and what makes a message different than all the information on that channel. And the distinction had to do with constraint. What he said was that what you want to do when you get information, to get at its aboutness, so to speak, is you have to figure out what information is no longer relevant. What are the possibilities that you can eliminate? That is, what you want to do when you transmit something is you want to eliminate uncertainty. Now, eliminating uncertainty is about creating something absent, constraining something, leaving something out. So implicit in the very notion of information as a signal, you've got normative issues. And by normative, I mean that you can get the information right or wrong. You can do the translation appropriately or inappropriately. But it also means that you have something else in an information channel, and that we may be dealing with here to some extent, noise. Noise is not intrinsic. Noise is a decision that we have to make about which bits of information are the useful ones, and which ones are the unuseful ones. That turns out to force us back into this realm where we're dealing with something absent, something present and something absent. What we want to do is to get rid of the noise and focus on the signal. But of course, if I'm a repair person looking at this electronic instrument, I might want to look at the noise as information to tell me about what's wrong. So the distinction between a signal that is a message and noise is actually an interpretive decision. It's a decision based upon which constraints you're going to focus on. So what I realized is that to get back to understanding the concept of information in its full sense to make it scientific, to make the aboutness scientific, even though it's something that's not there. It has to do with this relationship to something absent. One needed to use the concept of constraint, that constraint would help us do that. And the link to what we've just been talking about is that homeodynamic processes decrease constraint. Morphodynamic processes increase constraint, make things more regular, eliminate options. But teleodynamic processes preserve constraints. Once they're generated, you don't want them to go. Now, that's, of course, what information is about, what thinking is about, what life is about. And to say that life is an information process, it's not just passing on data. It's maintaining relationships of aboutness to the world. It's maintaining the noise and the signal separately from each other, knowing which is which, making that discernment. We needed a theory of information that brought us back into the world of meaning and significance. And we needed it in the sciences, not just in the humanities. We needed to sort of make absence safe for the sciences. So that that's how this fits together with this issue of normativity, of dynamics, of thermodynamics. It's interesting also that, of course, Shannon's theory of information was based upon the same kind of mathematics that is essential to thermodynamics. In fact, his measure of the amount of information that can be carried on a channel, he called the entropy of the channel, because mathematically, it's like the same measure that Ludwig Boltzmann used to measure the entropy of a physical system. And so there is an intrinsic relationship between the dynamics, between information in Shannon's sense, and information in the full sense of things that have aboutness and normativity to them.
Okay, so I would like to ask you, how do we get from those physical processes as you've been describing, and particularly from absence and constraints, to a better understanding of how mental phenomena, like, for example, consciousness and the self occur? I was going to say how they emerge, but I guess that that is a very complicated term to use here. So could you tell us about that?
I do think, I'll just say that I think understanding emergence without some of its baggage is important. I would say that my description of morphodynamics and teleodynamics, morphodynamic processes emerge from homeodynamic processes, and teleodynamic processes emerge from morphodynamic processes. And with each of those transitions, new kinds of features come into the world. So particularly with the teleodynamic system, what we're saying is that normative features emerge into the world. There were no normative features without teleodynamic systems in the world. Teleodynamics, because it maintains constraints, can be correct or incorrect, functional or non-functional. So normativity does emerge for the first time any place that teleodynamic processes show up. Only, of course, with respect to those teleodynamic processes. The rest of the world doesn't care whether teleodynamics preserves or not. But the challenge is that it's not going to be a quick jump from simple teleodynamics to minds. And I think we may be a little too anxious to make that move. And I like to tell people, no, let's take it one step at a time, baby steps, to get there. We have a long ways to go because, of course, life was around for, 3.5 billion years before any kinds of serious minds showed up. And by that, I'm talking about, maybe dinosaurs and fish and stuff that have brains. They're not minds in the full sense that we would think about it, but certainly beginning to represent the world and possibly having something that we would call consciousness. That takes a long time to show up in evolution, which means that there's a lot of steps between a basic teleodynamic system and this kind of a system. I like to describe it in the following sense. First of all, let's go back to the concept of information. All of life is about maintaining its constraints, and constraints are what maintain the information. Information is embodied in the constraints. That's what Shannon has taught us. And information in the aboutness sense is embodied in constraints. And in the useful sense, it's embodied in constraints, because information is only useful if it helps you do something. If you can do some work to accomplish something more efficiently because of the information you've got. Because I have information about the world, I don't have to make certain mistakes. I can use that information to constrain how I interact with the world. And so even usefulness is helped by this concept of constraint. And of course, doing work itself is about constraining the way we allow energy to be released. By doing that, we can change things in a focused way, in a constrained way. So the very concept of work itself is caught up in this concept. The problem is, how do we then go from these fairly basic ideas that should apply all the way down to bacteria, for example, to talk about minds and what mental processes are? Well, first of all, there's many, many steps. But I like to divide it into two different domains. One is to say that even a simple teleodynamic system, like a bacterium, has a kind of sentience. By that I mean that it senses the world. It doesn't have a sense of itself necessarily, but a bacterium or a plant has to respond to its world. It has to be sensitive to what's going on around it and organize itself and reorganize its physiology to compensate for those changes in the world. So using the concept of plants, I like to call this vegetative sentience. As it doesn't have awareness like we would describe it, but it's sensitive to the world, and it's sensitive in a way that is responsive to its own needs. So I like to call this vegetative sentience. And what I would say is that all life exhibits this kind of sentience, vegetative responsiveness to the world with respect to its own normativity. But that's not enough to explain what a brain is, what a mind does. And so the next question is, so what's the difference? My body has vegetative sentience, and in fact, every neuron in my brain has vegetative sentience. It's responding to the disturbances that other neurons are sending to it, that glucose and oxygen are providing around it in its metabolism. Each one of those cells has vegetative sentience. But it's not just that you put a whole bunch of vegetative sentience together and you get me, because you know that could describe my hand too, or my liver. It's got a whole bunch of vegetative sentience going on there. That's not enough. So the question is, how do we rethink the problem of what brains provide? Because using the term vegetative, I've literally sort of by implication noted that these creatures outside of my window here, these trees and plants and so on, they don't have brains. And as a result, they don't have a certain kind of sentience. And what's the difference? I like to call that difference subjective sentience, which is much more like what a philosopher might call what we're doing. I wouldn't want to call it consciousness necessarily, but certainly what even simple brains provide is a higher order form of sentience. And the question is, what is that higher order form of sentience? And what I realized is that we have to go back and rethink the concept of self. That's really behind this, because vegetative sentience is about a kind of self. It's all about maintaining and reproducing and sustaining a self, oneself, so to speak, even though you don't have a representation independently of what that self is. All of your organization, whether you're a plant or a bacterium, has that kind of organization. Interestingly enough, when you add a brain to an organism, and brains evolved with locomotion ultimately, as they evolved in creatures that have to get around and therefore predict their environments. Make predictions about environments that they haven't come to yet. They might come to. If you're just rooted to the ground, you just have to deal with what comes at you and maybe predict what's going to change season to season. But if you move, you want to find certain things. You're going towards ends that are of a different sort. And that seems to me to require a different kind of sentience. And what I like to say is that to some extent, it's what I call second order vegetative sentience. And what I mean by that is that it's vegetative sentience. All of my neurons, which are vegetatively sentient, that themselves are sentient collectively about the body that they're in, not just the world around them, not just their immediate neighbors. And so I think brains are also teleodynamically organized in the same sense of self-organizing systems, morphodynamic systems that are reciprocal to each other and create this kind of closure, create this kind of higher order telos. That is now no longer just the body. The body, and one of the reasons we have sort of this Cartesian notion of, you know, a ghost in a machine in our body, is that the environment of the brain is both the body it's in and the world that the body is in. So in a sense, if brains generate a higher order form of teleodynamics, that is by the dynamics of all of these neurons interacting with each other in response to bodies and the surrounding world, then what we've got is what you might call a vegetative sentience of vegetative sentience. So it's a higher order form of vegetative sentience. But that means that vegetative sentience, in a sense, is sentient of its own sentience. And I think that's the distinction that we need to focus on. So those of us that talk about consciousness, or where you find it these days, you know, we're talking about things that typically people do, brains do, and you know, what senses do, and so on and so forth. But we miss this very simple notion that it's about self. If we can't explain why something has self, why there's a form of telos, end-directedness, distinctive to that level of self, then we can't even get started with the explanation. We need to have a locus, an agency. That's what we're after with the concept of self. The key is that we can now see that there is a kind of self, a mode of self that all life has, and an additional mode of self within self that creatures with brains have. Add human beings to this, and we have yet another level of it, which has to do with our symbolic capacities and our ability to do what you and I are doing right now, exchanging ideas, trying to get in each other's heads, so to speak, figuring out what we each want, what we're each thinking, what we each know and don't know, and then react to it. But in that process, there's a sort of higher order perspective on self also that develops, so that we're aware of our own self as reflected in somebody else's self. I like to think of Adam and Eve as having made this discovery, because the first thing they do is they hide themselves. They hide their sex organs from each other. They suddenly have discovered that they can be seen by another self. Other animals don't have this for the most part, but I think we do. And this makes it so that it gives us a sort of virtual outside self that we can sort of look at ourselves with respect to. So it's even almost a third level of this process that we human beings have brought into the world. But the core story is still explaining what self is. If you can't explain how self comes into the world from dynamics, you can't even get started.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to get a complete picture of what you're trying to arrive at with your work, I guess it is also very important for us to understand how representative processes that occur in the brain arose from a from processes of natural selection, right? And I mean, even at a certain point when you were referring to vegetative sentience, it came to my mind that perhaps most of the representations that go around in our brain, we're not really aware of them. And I mean, there are many, many processes that go around, many operations that our brain does that we're not conscious about. So, I mean, even the consciousness part of things is not really that crucial to understand how these things happen, right?
What I would say is that we have been trapped into thinking in a sort of Cartesian sense that the consciousness part of our brain and the unconsciousness part of our brain are really separate. And the way I like to think about it is to deconstruct the notion of consciousness into a relatively differentiated form of teleodynamics. And I think we've fallen into the mistake of thinking of brain functions like we think about computing functions. And we these days oftentimes let these metaphors run easily back and forth between brain processes and these devices that we have, that we've created. On the other hand, we've forgotten the fact that brains, as you said, evolved biologically. Biology does not produce complexity the way that we produce complexity. And let me give you an example. When I want to create a complex thing, an artifact, I find a lot of things and I bring them together and I assemble them. I find a bunch of parts and I put them together in just the right way. I have a plan and I have a goal in mind, a telos, an end, a purpose. And if I'm lucky and my logic is correct, I'll get that function out in the end. When living things produce complexity, they don't put things together. My body was generated by starting from something that was already together, a fertilized ovum, a single cell, but it was undifferentiated. It did not have hands and feet and eyes and so on. What happened is over time, that system, by virtue of processes that involve morphodynamic processes, self-organizing processes, and involve evolution-like processes, selection-like processes as well, the embryo progressively differentiated. Complexity is produced in biology by beginning from undifferentiated whole systems that are already functioning, that are already complete in that sense, that then progressively differentiate. I think we need to recognize that if an evolved part of our bodies is there to generate complexity, it's almost certainly going to use biological logic to do it, not artifact logic to do it. Thoughts, cognition differentiate. They don't get created at the top level with an algorithm that's already organized. They differentiate. That means they start from an undifferentiated form. Before I've produced this sentence, I have an idea, we say, you know, this sort of crude, vague idea of what I want to talk about. But it's not a collection of words that I'm going to assemble. Yeah, the words were there in English. But that's not what I assembled. I differentiated that thought into words. And that means that there's a whole lot of processes that I'm thinking of as unconscious because they're undifferentiated. They are like that early stage embryo that doesn't have all the parts yet. And as that embryonic thought differentiates, matures, so to speak, to become a sentence or to become an idea that's clear, what's happened is that I've become more and more conscious of it as well. That is, consciousness is continually differentiating. It's not something that's just sort of at the top, floating on top of all of this machinery. But we tend to think about consciousness that way because the only part that we really attend to is sort of the end product, what I'm saying now. But in fact, I'm liminally conscious of all this other stuff. It's still going on. And in fact, if, you know, I had a sudden stroke and some little bit of that process was disturbed, it would become conscious to me. It would become conscious because the end differentiation process would no longer be what I expected and anticipated. That is, the differentiation would have been modified. So what I'm suggesting is that to some extent we have misconceived brain function. We've misconceived brain function by using this computational metaphor, this engineering metaphor, to apply too strongly to what's going on. As a result, we're going to have to rethink this process. We have to rethink brains as biologists, not as computer scientists, in order to figure out how it works. That also means that we can rethink computation and the things that we build to do this work. If we're ever going to produce what you might call not artificial intelligence, but artifactual intelligence, we're going to have to do it like brains do it. And that's a very different process. And so part of my interest is to sort of deal with that, to think about mental processes, neurological processes as differentiation processes. How do you rethink brain function and anatomy in those terms?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now for the last part of the interview, I would like to talk with you about the work you've done on language and semiotics. So I would like to ask you, how does semiotics work for you? Because I guess that the way semiotics originally as a discipline worked was that, and I might be mistaken about this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that initially people in semiotics were too focused on the symbols, and they were not really interested in trying to biologically ground the processes that they were describing. But you are interested in that. So could you tell us about that?
I think you've characterized that well. And it's really because there are two lineages that have not been fully resolved. One lineage begins with my favorite philosopher, Charles Sanders Peirce, who actually coined the term semiotics, although he borrows it from John Locke, who used the term initially to talk about cognition and so on. But what Charles Peirce was interested in was, in fact, just the inverse of what you're talking about. That is, to some extent, not all thought is in the form of symbols or words. We human beings, we're so anthropocentric, we sort of think of everything in linguistic terms. You know, that as though language is the be-all and end-all of communication, and other forms of communication are sort of lesser or ancillary to this. As a biologist, it's very clear to me that language, symbolic thought, is the most odd, the most recent, the most unusual form of communication to have evolved. And as a result, it evolved out of other forms of communication that precede it and, in fact, undergird it, are its foundation. And Charles Peirce was very interested in talking about all the ways that information is encoded, is passed on, and so on, and interpreted. The other strain comes from people who study linguistics and basically, I think, traces a lot of its focus back on a man named Ferdinand de Saussure, who initiated what we might call modern structural linguistics. And he argued that what you really have to pay attention to is the relationship between what he called a signifier, like a word, and a signified, the idea or thing it represents. And as a result, thinking from language, that's all you have to worry about. The problem there is that the signifier-signified relationship looks sort of like a code relationship. And it often has brought to mind issues of arbitrarity, for example, so that the signifier, the word that I'm using right now, has very little in common, except that we've accepted it has in common with what it's referring to. On the other hand, a picture carries some of the form of that which it's referring. A fever is directly correlated with the body state that might be inferred from studying the fever. Charles Peirce was more interested in those and, in effect, recognized that iconic, that is, likeness representations, and indexical, these correlated representations, were more basic than language, more basic than symbolic communication. And, in fact, that symbolic communication, to some extent, grows out of them. Now, as a biologist studying the origins of language, I became interested initially in other animals' forms of communication. And they do not use words or anything like words. They use a lot of icons and indices. That is, they use a lot of likenesses in their behavior, a lot of anticipatory behaviors, but also a lot of indexical behaviors. Vocalizations mostly indicate a state of emotionality or arousal. In fact, for you and I, we also have these. Laughter and sobbing are good examples of these things that are very good indications of a particular state of mind, including things like smiling and gesturing with our hands and so on. They don't have definitions, for example, where words might have a definition. You know, what's the definition of a smile or a laugh? Well, it doesn't have those things. And not only that, the other difference is that words are interdefined. We define words with other words. We don't define laughs with respect to grimaces and cries and waving of the hands or winks. No, it's not. They're defined with respect to their immediate linkage with a state of mind, a state of arousal. So what I realized early on in the study of language is that you couldn't study the origins of language and how we gained this possibility without understanding how it developed out of these other forms of sign. And that required semiotics, not just linguistics. Semiotics is an attempt to say, what are all the possible ways that information about things can be passed on? And what are the different structures? Peirce's identification of these three modes, iconic, indexical, and symbolic, helped me understand that and helped me understand that to interpret symbols, to interpret words, we actually have to use the way that words point, index other words. We have to have them bring to mind icons, sensory experiences, likenesses. When we analyze a sentence, it's sort of like analyzing a diagram. The way the words relate to each other has a structure, and that structure is sort of like the idea structure behind that. And a structure, of course, is a form, is an icon. So to some extent, what I realized is that the only way you could really study the origins of language was first of all to get a really good handle on how the symbolic capacities were built upon iconic and indexical capacities. And more recently, it's led me to realize that every child has to deal with this problem. That is, they have to, in the first 2 years of life, figure out how to use sign vehicles, symbols, that don't carry any hint in their structure about what they're about. This has sometimes been called ungrounded signs. These signs aren't grounded because they don't carry anything in their intrinsic features that allow you to figure out what it's about. But children begin life dealing with exactly this problem in trying to communicate with adults and other children. That is, they need to be grounded. They need to figure out how to get things, how to get people's attention, how to aim somebody else's attention to what you want by pointing, for example, using all kinds of iconic and indexical capacities. And they have to use these to sort of figure out how then to use sign vehicles that don't have these properties to do the same thing. And this is a problem that I like to call the moving towards ungrounding, the ungrounding process. The advantage of being able to use sign vehicles that don't have these characteristics is that they're much more manipulable. By combining them, instead of having each one of them have all the information, you can now produce much more diversity of reference, much more freedom to communicate, and to, as we know now, to encode almost anything, including all the novel ideas we've been talking about today, things that one may not have thought about before this. That's the power of it. But you can't do that if your sign vehicles carry within them the structure of what they represent. You have to, in a sense, have moved to this symbolic level where you've thrown that away. But that means the relationships between the symbols, between the words and the morphemes, the endings and the beginnings of words and so on, have to carry the iconic and indexical functions. So that grammar and syntax ought to be reanalyzed semiotically. And one of the things I'm trying to urge my linguistic colleagues to do is to get out of the mode that they think that, no, words are just sort of arbitrarily related to the world and you need rules to organize them. No, what you need is to recognize that the relationships between words, those relationships, the spaces, so to speak, the connections, have to be doing the iconic and indexical work. And that means that grammar and syntax should itself be explainable semiotically. But you've got to get to semiotics. You've got to get to icons and indices. If you stay with just symbols, you can never see it.
Okay, so if language is the result of several cognitive building blocks that we have acquired through our evolutionary history, let's say, of course, I guess that we share some of them with other species, right? So would you say that language is strictly a human cognitive phenomenon, or that might be other species that also have it?
Well, so the first thing that I did as a graduate student, I spent a little more than a decade trying to understand what was different about human brains that made language possible that seemed so unlikely to show up in any other species. The surprising feature is that every time I looked, it was something in common. There are no new major structures in the human brain. It's not really structured differently. It's a fairly typical ape brain. Yes, it's bigger, and there's some proportional differences and maybe a few connectional differences, but they're pretty subtle. And yet, language is so radically unusual in the animal world. So, you know, it was this troublesome problem that the substrate didn't look that different, but the result of this function was radically different. Not only that, most vocalization communication is not controlled cortically in other species. It's controlled mostly subcortically in the midbrain and in the basal forebrain. And yet most of language requires cortex. Interestingly enough, a recent study done here at Berkeley by some of my colleagues has shown that almost the entire cerebral cortex is involved in understanding meaning of words. So there's this wonderful study in which they look at how words are effectively meaning extraction from words is tiled across the cerebral cortex. Almost all of both hemispheres are involved in word analysis. So that to some extent, what's happened is that these are structures that evolved to do other things, movement, auditory processes, and so on, and visual processes. They still do those things, but they've also been recruited into language as well. So something has happened to re-recruit all of these structures to do this wonderful new thing that we're doing right now. That makes us radically different in so many things, and of course has changed the world because of it. Now, what's interesting is that one has to then understand, so what's the subtle change that made this possible, and how did it come about? Now, the real problem, of course, is that languages and speech and communication doesn't fossilize. We don't have any hint of that that we can look at. The good news is that our brains are very similar to other brains. And the differences are the result of the way they have developed differently. is a slight tweak in development. Evolution is about changing the process of development from generation to generation, just subtly. Well, the process of developing human brains is changed slightly, which makes them larger, has changed a few connection patterns, changed some of the neurotransmission, and so on. Understanding those differences is the way we're going to get at these questions. So I spent the first decade to two decades of my career as a graduate student and eventually a young professor trying to answer the question, what's different about human brains? Because if I figure out what's different about human brains, I might figure out how this transition was made. It turns out that the two questions actually fit well together. What's different about human brains and what's different about communicating with symbols? The very ungroundedness of symbols that required somehow reusing iconic and indexical features in a different way posed a different kind of thinking problem. And the problem had to do with the combinatorial features in particular. The fact that we have to combine words to actually communicate anything. And so this allowed me to look at the brain differently and to say, well, so what parts of the brain might have contributed to this capacity? It's not that we have some special language device plugged into the brain that makes language possible. It's just that we enhance this capacity to make it possible so that we could make this shift that's so difficult for other species. And it turns out that I think that the major difference has to do with an area called the prefrontal cortex. And people have long wondered if the prefrontal cortex might be overdeveloped in humans. It's slightly larger than you'd predict for a brain, even of our size, and considerably larger than for a brain of, say, chimpanzee size, about a third the size of ours. There are connection differences as well, connections from the motor cortex to the nucleus in our brainstem that controls the larynx and breathing that allows us to precisely time vocalizations with the movement of my mouth and tongue, something that you couldn't do in other species because they don't have this direct connection. But it looks as though this direct connection is the result of this sort of expanded growth of the forebrain compared to this deep brain nucleus. The real problem is that, of course, this didn't precede language. It's not that this happened and then language can pop into place. It happens slowly. And we can guess at that by looking at the developmental processes that are necessary and also looking at the way brain sizes changed from our ancestors. And we know at least the size information, although structure information, even though people think they can tell by looking at shapes of skulls and things like that, I think that's pretty unlikely. But we can know that in order to build a brain of a different size, using the same kind of plan that other apes use, that certain things had to be tweaked in certain ways. And that probably took place over the course of almost 2 million years, I think. And what it suggests to me is that early on in this process, a little bit of symbolic communication had to have been possible. The very minimal capacities. But that demanded much more work for certain parts of our brain. And as a result, those who, by chance, had slight modifications neurologically to make that combinatorial analysis easier would acquire this symbolic capacity a little bit better. I actually think it didn't begin linguistically. I think it probably began something looking more like a ritual looks like. Where we can communicate about things by this complicated mixture of icons, indices, and to create symbols. One of the things about a symbol is it's created by these relationships between icons and indices. So when I use a particular word, you know, it's because it brings to mind these relationships to other words and other events and other properties and principles and so on. It's these relationships, this network of relationships, that's critical. Well, that's, of course, what we do when we construct a ritual. We bring things into relationship in a particular way. So I think that the early process begins probably somewhere close to almost 2 million years ago, about 500,000 years after we see the first appearance of stone tools. And what had to happen, of course, using stone tools, we have to cooperate in very different ways in order to gain access to this food source that stone tools allowed our early ancestors to gain access to. And that requires cooperation, but it also requires something a little bit like what Rousseau would call a social contract. Promises. You've got to know what to expect from somebody else. And you've got to have assurances that when I've got my head down in a carcass carving off a piece of meat, that my buddies are fending off the predators that want to get at it too, that would get at me if I wasn't paying attention. We've got to have that kind of trust. We've also got to have trust about sexual processes, about how we interact in mating and taking care of offspring and so on. A whole lot of new kinds of communication had to be necessary to sort of utilize this new simple technology, but to gain a food source. I think so. So what I argued in my book, in The Symbolic Species, is that there was this co-evolutionary process, that very simple symbolic processes drove the evolution, caused the brains to do a little better at acquiring them, which created better symbolic processes, which in turn sort of ratcheted up this process step by step by step until modern times. I think there are lots of other processes involved. One of them, in fact, I think requires loss of specificity. So some of my recent work has been to identify in species that have gone from a particular bird species we're looking at that's gone from an innate song to a socially acquired and socially transmitted song, is that actually there's been a loss of specificity, a loss of innate capacities that made this possible. I think there's been a loss of innate bias, innate specificity, as well as this specialization towards combinatorial capacity. I think a lot of things have happened in common that allow us to do what we do. But it's also allowed communication to become socially created and socially transmitted. So almost all of our communication now has this major capacity, which means that those of us in different language groups, of course, are tied off from each other, you know, because we don't have that translation. We don't have the common background because it's so social. But it took a long time to get here. And I don't think it's just a recent gloss on top of being a little more intelligent. Our brains are symbolic brains. I like to say that we have a symbolic nature. Instead of human nature, it's human symbolic nature. That is, everything about us has been modified by a couple of million years of adapting to this virtual world of symbols. We're not just adapting to the ecosystems we're in. We're now adapting to this very different ecosystem that's virtual. It's about what might happen, what could have happened, what should happen, what did happen. All of that is part of our evolution. And so I think our bodies and our brains reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so at a certain point there you referred to, and I mean, this is obvious, that language doesn't fossilize. And one of the main sources of evidence to study how language might have evolved are brains, and comparing our own brain with the brains of other species that are evolutionarily close to us. But at another point, you refer to the fact that perhaps we can extract or make some inferences about how people were communicating with each other through human tools. But since language is very related to our capacity to process symbolism, wouldn't you say that perhaps there are also other cultural artifacts, like, for example, artistic products that we can study archaeologically to try to get a sense of how people were processing symbols throughout our evolutionary history?
Part of the challenge is that what we would describe as non-functional artifacts, non-tools, are very recent. We don't see a lot of it. I would say some of the earliest ones are still only a few hundred thousand years old. And one of the problems with symbolic communication, going right back to where we began this conversation, is what's absent. Sounds and gestures disappear immediately. The sounds that I'm uttering now, you know, are gone, except that you're recording them. For the most part, nothing gets preserved. So one would imagine that for a good period, and I would say 80% to 90% of our prehistory, the symbols that were being used produce nothing. The problem is, what gets things externalized? The challenge is that, to some extent, if we wanted to use evidence, external clear fossil evidence or hard evidence of language, we would go to writing. Writing is our sure evidence that there's language being spoken because it's encoding the language. But writing is only, you know, 8, 10,000 years old at the most. And in most parts of the world, not anywhere near that. But we can be sure that language preceded it for a long, long time. It's just that at that point in time, it became necessary to externalize it, to put it into an artifact that was preserved, that didn't dissipate into the atmosphere, so to speak. Well, when we look at cave paintings that might be 20 to 30,000 years old at the oldest, we should think the same thought. Now people are beginning to externalize something. Why did they externalize it? Why didn't they do it before this? Or were they doing it on artifacts that simply degraded over time? Carved wood, woven things that degraded. Now, one of the oldest, I think, interesting artifacts is this sort of pink hand axe that was found in Spain many years ago. Basically unused, are wonderfully carved, shaped into a hand axe, which has this sort of probably the oldest, longest used kind of tool in our ancestry, that was never used, but was carved out of this gorgeous pink stone, and seems to have been tossed into a repository, maybe even as a sort of a funeral-like object. It's one of the oldest ones, but it's one of the very few. My guess is that, first of all, we can't use the absence of externalized features, of externalized symbolic or iconic features, to gauge the timing of this stuff. On the other hand, what we can say is there, for some reason, it was important for the people in those days to externalize these things. And that's the question we want to ask. But when you externalize something, of course, it lasts a long time, and therefore it can have an influence long past your own influence. So today, we still are influenced by the writings of Greek literature and so on. Influenced by religious writings that are thousands of years old, that still drive major political and economic and religious movements around the world. Because artifacts persist and continually have communicative influence. That is a fairly recent phenomenon, and I think it's a phenomenon that begins this ratchet-like effect that we call history. Before that, I think it wasn't there. On the other hand, I do think that we have to recognize that some of these first things that show up, like the cave walls, paintings, or carvings that represent things, iconic things, are associated with something else that symbols provides. Symbols provide the ability, because of their combinatorial nature, to bring ideas together in new ways. I think that the arts are the result of this. The arts are not the kind of thing that you find in the rest of the animal world, because this combinatorial possibility is just so rare. Yes, you might find a little of that kind of stuff out there, but it's very, very minimal, or it only occurs in very, very special conditions. But with human beings, it somehow is right there. So this is why I say ritual, but we might say some of the original kinds of art, maybe even drumming or rhythmic activity, maybe even something a little bit like music, would have been some of this first stuff. Playing a role as symbolic, but also as iconic and indexical, and playing a communicative role that was well beyond what we would call language. So one of the things that's unique about us is not only our ability to do this, but our desire to experience it and to make it. I mean, this is an attractive thing. We really like this stuff. So it basically says that to some features of our symbolic nature, so to speak, bias us towards not only being able to do it, but wanting to do it, being attracted to it. Because this is a way of sort of building this larger symbolic world around us. I think it also has changed us in another important way. We have, and this is a neurological issue in some sense, and that is all mammal brains do memory in two very different orthogonal sort of independent ways. Memory is the result of redundancy, of repetition of things. We know that we learn skills by repeating something over and over again. And in effect, cutting deeper and deeper channels into the synaptic pathways so that things become more automatic, more efficient, and so on by virtue of repetition. We call this procedural memory. And to some extent, the more we get good at something, the less conscious it is. It's more like what a computer does. In a sense, it's becoming, you know, a one-track mind, so to speak, a one-trick pony, as it's sometimes described. On the other hand, to remember what you were doing just before lunch yesterday, you didn't have a chance to repeat that. That happened once. But by me just mentioning it, you can probably go back to figure out what it was. You can remember that, even though it was not repeated. And most of the episodes in our life don't have that kind of repetition. They have a sort of theme and variation, especially if we have sort of predictable lives. And we use that theme and variation oftentimes to go back and find it, to structure our memories. That kind of memory is called an episodic memory, episodes, so to speak. Sometimes it's called declarative memory because we can describe and we can declare what happened, so to speak. I think that's a misnomer because it sneaks language into the game. But what's interesting about language is that we acquire our ability to speak and understand language procedurally by repeatedly experiencing this throughout the first years of our lives. We don't actually remember the episodes that we learned all these words in. And there's a good reason for that the episodic memory actually develops quite a bit later. And these two memories involve very different kinds of the brain, different parts of the brain, because they have to do it differently. One has to do it by repetition, and episodes have to be remembered by association. So instead of redundancy by virtue of doing the same thing over and over again, it's redundancy about what things are in common. You know, and this is how we typically find this. You know, what else was I doing? What else, you know, how can I zero in on this memory? We do it by association. But of course, language is something that is done using procedural memory, skill memory. I don't even have to think about it as I produce it now, to access our episodic memory. In fact, when I asked you about what you were doing before lunch yesterday, it was using that very capacity. Now, what that means is that then also an episode can trigger me to come up with new words and new terms procedurally to drive my access to new episodes. This ability to link episodes together into complicated sequences we call narrative or theory or explanation. What we've done by using language is we've totally restructured the nature of memory in a mammalian brain. We don't have new kinds of memory systems, but we're using this technology we call language, symbols, to restructure memory. So when I remember the stuff I'm talking about today, or you remember your childhood or who you are or what you're planning to do, we do it typically in something like stories, in narratives. or in theories or in explanations, where we've linked things together in these complicated memories. That's something that's unique to us as well, that language has given us, and so that we, in a sense, don't any longer live in just the immediate moment. We live in the coming future, my plans. We live in the past, where I came from, what I was doing before, why I'm doing what I am now. And we have the capacity to live in other people's stories as well. Mm-hmm. And that includes getting into each other's heads in ways that other species can't do. Because I can tell you what I'm thinking, like I am now. And you can ask me questions to get into what I'm thinking, and I can do the same for you.
Okay, great. So, Dr. Deacon, today we've already covered a lot of topics coming from your work. So, just before we go, would you like to tell people perhaps what are some of the best places on the internet for them to go there and find more stuff about your work?
So, we are in the process of constructing a website called Teleodynamics that will have most of the papers related to my work and other work. But there are some great new journals beginning in terms of semiotics. There's a journal called Cognitive Semiotics that's coming out that has now had a few years of work. Another journal called Biosemiotics that has a lot of applications of semiotic theories to biology. In terms of the work that I'm doing on information, I should mention that I'm the current president of an organization called the International Society for the Study of Information, and we're going to have this beginning June in Berkeley, the current meeting of this society, in which there's a lot of interest not in information just in the technical sense, but information in all of its broad senses. And that group, the initials IS4, number 4, SI, stand for that organization, and there's a subgroup called the Foundations of Information Science, FIS, in which there's an ongoing discussion about these issues. These are topics that are beginning to pop up all over the place. They're still fairly new. We have just begun to sort of move in this direction, but it's a good place to go to begin to see what's happening in these domains.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will be leaving links in the description box of this video for people to go to those places if they are interested, of course. So, Dr. Deacon, again, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It was really a pleasure to everyone.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Hi guys, thank you so much for watching this video until the end. I would also like to ask you to please pay a visit to my Patreon page and see if you can make a pledge there. I would really be thankful for that. And finally, I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons Karen Litske, Anne Blanche, Per Helga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantal Gelinas, and Jim Frank. Thank you a lot for all.